On Wednesday, February 7th, 2007, at UCSC, author and media critic Norman Solomon received the third annual Ruben Salazar Journalism Award. A nationally syndicated columnist on media and politics since 1992, Solomon has written 11 books. His latest, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, was published in July of 2005. Solomon is also founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which facilitates communication between independent policy analysts and working journalists. The annual Ruben Salazar Award honors the memory of independent journalist Ruben Salazar, who was killed during a Vietnam War protest in East Los Angeles when he was hit at close range in the head by a police tear gas canister. Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman and co-host Juan Gonzalez are previous award winners. And before we hear from Norman Solomon, we'll be hearing the voice of Otilio Quintero. He is the assistant director of Santa Cruz's Barrios Unidos, and he introduced Norman Solomon.
In introducing our honored guest, we had an opportunity to talk a little bit. And I talked a little bit about the commonalities in the work that we do at Barrios Unidos and the work that he's done. And as we talk about the truth, and we talk about the realities of that truth. In the work that we do, a lot of times we're up competing with the veteranos in the street corner who are telling the young homies, hey, come on, man, you know, if you join in, you got family, you know, you got fame, you know, we're there for you, we're down for you. But unfortunately, they don't hear the other side. The truth to the lie, which is there is no family. When you do finally get locked up, you realize that nobody comes to visit you. Nobody puts money in your books. Nobody even writes. They forget about you. And so that's the other side of the story that we try to tell the young people who are on the street corners looking for a way out, looking for an alternative to the madness that they're in. And for a lot of them, they have no choice. They're born into the violence, the drugs, the abuse. So as they're looking for an answer, there's a lot of people there ready to give them their answer. And so as I talked to Norman, I says, you know, we're there competing, trying to respond to the lies and trying to give the truth. And Norman goes, well, that's kind of what I do and the work that I've done to try to respond to the lies, to try to respond with the truth. And it's hard when you're out there on the street corner because you look behind you and you ain't got nobody. But what you do have is the truth. You have the spirit that says, no matter what, I know in the end, the truth is going to come out, and I'll be okay. And sometimes that's all we got. And so, as we invite and welcome our guests to our community, to Santa Cruz, is we also acknowledge the fact that there are people out there that are willing to respond and tell that truth. And so in the various books that he's written, War Made Easy and others, he's out there on the street corner trying to get a message out to all of those who are trying to find out what is the truth. And so through his work, he's been acknowledged, received various awards, has written various articles, journals, has been on numerous TV shows trying to get the message out, trying to get the truth out. And I think for me, one of the biggest acknowledgments is Norman Solomon won the George Ordwell Award for Distinguished Contribution to Honesty and Clarity in Public Language. And so the fact that he is being recognized, his words are being heard, I think that we as a community need to know what is being said, what is the truth And then how do we take that truth and incorporate it into our own lives so that we become that person on the street corner and we tell the other side of the story? Because I got to tell you, what we call barrio warriors, they come in different shape, different sizes, different colors. And we have to ask ourselves sometimes, what are we going to do with that information? What are we going to do with that knowledge? And so maybe we can become that person on the street corner, giving the other side of the story, trying to confront the lie. Because it's really easy to just kick back and do nothing and say nothing. So we're honored today to have someone who's going to share with us a little bit of the truth. And hopefully that'll get us to think about what our role is as those barrio warriors. Because when I look out, I see two things. I see a strong group of individuals that are looking for a way to use that positive energy. And I also see future barrio warriors. So I'd like for all of you to assist me in welcoming Norman Solomon, writer, activist, and truth teller. Let's give him a hand of applause.
Tonight, I think more than in any other sense, from my standpoint, we're here to honor the spirit of Ruben Salazar in the way that I feel confident he would most want us to. And that is to look within ourselves and to dedicate and rededicate ourselves to changing the world in a way that is consistent with what we truly believe in, our values, not just the talk that we see talked, but what we yearn to come in the form of walking the walk. I'm going to speak a little bit later, but initially there's a clip of a film coming out in the spring that we're going to see here. You might call it a sneak preview. The narration is temporary, but you will get the gist in terms of the adaptation of the War Made Easy film. And as you look back at the decades that the section of the film covers, I don't think there's any question you'll be thinking about 2007 in the process. So without further ado, I think we probably will have the lights dim and on with the film. Thank you for being here. Point of the UN is part of selling the war to the American public. It's almost a good war-making seal of approval. First you go to the UN, then you go to war. It's a scam because the net effect is to go through the motions.
And I am continuing and I am increasing the search for every possible path to peace.
Whether we're talking about President Johnson or President Nixon or the president today, you have one chief executive after another in the White House saying how much they love peace and hate war.
But even as planes of the multinational forces attack Iraq, I prefer to think of peace, not war.
The United States wants peace, not conflict.
We seek peace. We strive for peace.
Every president of the last half century has gone out of his way to say that he wanted peace and wanted to avoid war.
I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace.
Even while ordering military action.
And I still think we ought to take the dice off now. I think the left-brown people, we have to talk about it. No, I'd rather use a nuclear bomb. That's right. And that, I think, would just be too much. The nuclear bomb, that probably... I just want you to think big, Henry, for Christ's sake.
So you have this paradox, in a way, of the president who has just ordered massive military violence and lethal action by the Pentagon, turning around and saying, I want to oppose violence and promote peace.
I respect your idealism. I share your concern for peace. I want peace as much as you do.
Actually, war becomes perpetual when it's used as a rationale for peace.
Good afternoon. Today, I ordered our armed forces to strike at terrorist-related facilities in Afghanistan and Sudan.
My fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama.
7 o'clock this evening, Eastern Time, air and naval forces of the United States launched a series of strikes against the headquarters, terrorist facilities, and military assets that support Muammar Gaddafi's subversive activities.
Once public support is in place and war is finally launched, the news media shifts from covering the rationales for war to covering war itself. Influencing the nature of war coverage has been a priority of one administration after another since Vietnam, when conventional wisdom held that it was negative media coverage that turned the American people against the war and forced U.S. withdrawal. Since that time, and beginning with new urgency during the first Gulf War, the Pentagon has worked with increasing sophistication to shape media coverage of war. As then-Defense Secretary Dick Cheney noted, frankly, I looked on it as a problem to be managed. The information function was extraordinarily important. I did not have a lot of confidence that I could leave it to the press.
Particularly in the early stages, news coverage of war is much more like PR about war. So for the invasion of Grenada and invasion of Panama in 83 and 89, then the Gulf War in early 1991, it was like a produced TV show, and the main producers were at the Pentagon. They decided, in the case of the Gulf War, exactly what footage would be made available to the TV stations. They did nonstop briefings utilizing the increasing importance of cable television. They named it Operation Desert Storm so it could run at the bottom of the screen. All that sort of stuff was very calculated. So you could look at that as a kind of an era of media war manipulation from the standpoint of the U.S. government, where they were tightly controlling the access that reporters had to the actual fighting.
I've fallen almost in love with the F-18 Super Hornet because it's quite a versatile plane.
The Pentagon's influence on war coverage is also evident in the news media's tendency to focus on the latest weaponry.
Every war from Vietnam to the present moment, we have U.S. news media that have praised the latest in the state-of-the-art killing technology.
1, 2, 3, 4, we dropped a bomb, but now a tremendous G-load as we pull out of that dive. Oh, I know something of what those astronauts must go through. Wow.
Well, Colonel, it's a great way to go to war.
And there's a kind of idolatry there. Some might see it as worship of the gods of metal.
In fact, even as U.S. military technology has become increasingly sophisticated with the development of smart bombs and other forms of so-called precision-guided weaponry, civilian casualties now greatly outnumber military deaths, a grim toll that has steadily increased since World War I.
This is the beginning of the shock and awe campaign. According to one official, this is going to be the entire 9 yards.
There's kind of an acculturated callousness towards what happens at the other end of U.S. weapons. And this is another very insidious aspect of war propaganda.
The targeting capabilities and the care that goes into targeting to see that the precise targets are struck and that other targets are not struck is as impressive as anything anyone could see. The care that goes into it, the humanity that goes into it, to see that military targets are destroyed, to be sure, but that it's done in a way and in a manner and in a direction and with a weapon that is appropriate to that very particularized target. The weapons that are being used today have a degree of precision that no one ever dreamt of.
Within this war-friendly news frame, the Defense Department has also been successful in shaping actual war reporting. Its influence reached new heights with the embedding of journalists during the war in Iraq.
The Pentagon tightly controlled the media during the 1991 Persian Gulf War, limiting where reporters could go and often restricting access to small groups of pool reporters. This time, the Pentagon is doing an about-face. After running more than 230 journalists through media boot camps, the Pentagon is inviting more than 500 media representatives to accompany U.S. combat units to war.
The strategy of embedding reporters with troops has raised new questions about the ability of war reporters to convey balanced information to the American people.
Rather than being kept far away, they were embraced and smothered and participated in the process of being smothered. They were brought along, hundreds and hundreds of them, with the Marines, with the Navy, with the Army. They became, in a sense, part of the invading apparatus. You didn't have embedded reporters with people who are being bombed. You only had embedded reporters with the bombers. And it was through the eyes of the invaders that so much of the reporting was done.
You know, it was a gradual process of getting to know and trust each other.
People who were correspondents for the major U.S. TV networks would express in no uncertain terms that they had been bonding very closely with the U.S. soldiers.
Our presence actually helped morale in the unit. They liked having us there. They liked me calling Atlanta and saying, these are the 16 teams in the Sweet 16.
Well, that's very nice, except it has nothing to do with independent journalism, which we never need more than in times of war.
I doubt that in a conflict of this type there's ever been the degree of free press coverage as you are witnessing in this instance.
It was a very shrewd effort by the Pentagon to say, you want access? Here's plenty of access. And the embedding process was actually a new wrinkle in an old game, which was and is propaganda for war.
Praise for the embedding process as a step forward in balanced war reporting has often been framed against the backdrop of media coverage of the Vietnam War.
A myth has kind of grown up after the Vietnam War that their reporting was very tough, that Americans saw on their television sets the brutality of the war as it unfolded. And people often hark back to that as a standard that should now be rediscovered or emulated.
This is what the war in Vietnam is all about.
Yes, there was exceptional reporting, but it was the exception. And so you had the Zippo lighters being used by the GIs burning down the huts of a village that Morley Safer on CBS reported. Well, people mentioned that actually because it was unusual. And in point of fact, very little about the tremendous violence in that war was conveyed through the television set, especially when the U.S. government is responsible for the human suffering. That is, in a way, the most taboo, to show in detail, in graphic human detail, what's involved when bombs, missiles, mortars paid for by U.S. taxpayers do what they're designed to do, which is to kill and to maim.
I know that this is a great concern. I think it's part of the Vietnam Syndrome.
The Vietnam Syndrome that President Reagan mentioned was a reference to America's attempt to forget its most unpopular war.
That this will not be another Vietnam. Our troops will have the best possible support in the entire world, and they will not be asked to fight with one hand tied behind their back.
Like President Reagan before him, President Bush explicitly set out to rid the national psyche of the so-called Vietnam Syndrome, the widely held belief, after the bloody and protracted conflict in Vietnam, that the American public no longer had the stomach for war unless guaranteed swift, easy, and decisive victory.
Precision weapons and the strategic use of air power helped make the Gulf War an enormous operational victory for the Pentagon, helping it move past the legacy of Vietnam.
It's a proud day for America, and by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all.
Thank you very, very much.
For decades, presidents and commentators have been denouncing what they call the
Vietnam syndrome, which is taken to be an undue reticence on the part of the public to support military intervention in the wake of what happened in Vietnam.
I frankly think it's an example of the continuing Vietnam syndrome that drives us to have extreme reluctance to use military force.
The idea is that supposedly the public is not willing to back strong military action because people have become too skittish about U.S. casualties. In fact, if you look at the actual course of public opinion, there's been a real willingness to support wars, without exception, at the beginning. And the opposition builds only if the war goes on for a long time without victory, and also if the war goes on to such an extent that people begin to understand that deception was at the core of launching it in the first place.
That renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required...
It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy. We got there just in time.
Embassies being starved, people being shot, women being raped. It is brutal, and I will continue to remind the rest of the world that this must not stand.
Stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein
now has weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction.
With weapons of mass destruction.
Botulin, VX, sarin, nerve agent.
And terrorism.
Cyber attacks.
Nuclear program.
Biological weapons.
Cruise missiles, ballistic missiles.
Chemical and biological weapons.
Ties with Al-Qaeda.
And there are Al-Qaeda terrorists inside Iraq.
First, the public has to be sold on the need to attack. Then, after the war is underway, withdrawal needs to be put forward as an unacceptable option, as long as the White House sees it that way.
Withdrawal of all American forces from Vietnam would be a disaster.
Let no one think for a moment that retreat from Vietnam would bring an end to conflict.
If we're not leaving so long as I'm the president, that would be a huge mistake.
Our allies would lose confidence in America.
To yield to force in Vietnam would weaken that confidence.
Any sign that says we're going to leave before the job is done simply emboldens terrorists?
It would not bring peace. It would bring more war.
And many propaganda lines become stock and trade of those who started the war in the first place.
The American people will not stand for surrender.
Cowards cut and run.
Cutting and running.
If we hightailed it and cut and run.
Cut and run.
We
will not cut and run.
Cut and run. Cut and run. How do you respond?
We will stay the course.
We must stay the course.
We stay the course.
We will stay the course.
And we're not going to cut and run if I'm in the Oval Office.
What was happening in 1970 when a Los Angeles sheriff killed Ruben Salazar? A war had been going on in Southeast Asia for many years, while the U.S. government, led by first President Johnson and then President Nixon, lied about the origins and conduct of the war. And the opinion polls, which during the 1960s first showed a great deal of support for the Vietnam War, had begun to turn so that a majority of the population were telling pollsters that they no longer supported the war. And yet the president said the war had to go on. In short, what was going on in 1970 was in many ways very similar to what is going on in 2007. And on the day that Ruben Salazar was murdered, tens of thousands of Latinos had marched through the streets during the Chicano Moratorium Day protest to make their voices heard against the war in Vietnam, which was being fought largely by poor people, people of color, which was being fought at the behest of a power structure that those disadvantaged by the system groups had very little way of affecting. And so the organizing was going on, and Ruben Salazar was a journalist who functioned with an independent professional mindset within mainstream media. He
was a columnist for the Los Angeles Times when he was killed. Before that, he'd been a reporter for the LA Times. He was a high-ranking news official at KMEX television, at that point the only major TV outlet, or any to speak of, that served Chicanos in the United States. He had covered Vietnam as a correspondent in that country during the war, and he had come back to Los Angeles and written about another form of violence, police violence against Mexican Americans, violence that was supported by the same power structure that was maintaining the war in Vietnam. And he was hated by police officials. And in some sense, you might say there's evidence that an extrajudicial killing took place. Keep in mind, he was a very mainstream journalist who knew the craft, who knew how to function as a journalist, who was expert as an investigative reporter. He was no radical, except in the sense that he believed in the First Amendment. He understood that journalism is the lifeblood of a democracy. And one way to look at it is, you know, you have the body politic, and the free circulation of information and ideas is essential for the survival of that democratic body politic. And if you have blockage, if you don't have that circulation of ideas and information and free debate, what happens in a body when there's blockage in the circulation? Well, we know. You have essentially a stroke or a coronary. Well, we've been living through decades and decades and decades of the political equivalent of blockage, of strokes, of coronaries. And I'm not just being hyperbolic here or metaphorical. In 1970, in a room such as this on a UC campus, everybody in the room would know people who had been to Vietnam, some of whom had not come back, many more of whom had come back with physical injuries, and many, many more who had come back with the kind of injuries that show no scars, but are virtually impossible to heal. 2 days ago, I was outside the gates of Fort Lewis, Washington, where Lieutenant Aaron Watada began undergoing a court-martial proceeding Monday morning. He was charged with conduct unbecoming of an officer. Why? Because last year he made public statements denouncing the war in Iraq as illegal and immoral. And so two counts faced him on that charge of conduct unbecoming of an officer and a gentleman. 2 years in prison, hanging in the balance. 2 more years for a total of 4 potential sentence for refusing to deploy, for being given an order to get on that bus, to get on that plane, to go to Iraq. And he said no. Well, outside the gates, I met Carlos Arredondo. Monday morning, he was there with a car that he had driven across the country. And on the windows were pasted big photographs of his son, Alexander, who 2.5 years ago, at age 20, was killed in Iraq. And when Carlos answered the knock at the door, and the Marines informed him that his son had been killed in Iraq, he asked those Marines to leave his house. And when they didn't leave his house, in an overwhelming wave of grief and rage, he went out to the Marine van outside of where he lived, and he set it on fire. And on Monday, he showed me some of the scars from the fire, which burned about a third of his body. And I knew that while those burns had largely healed, there was something going on in him that never would. Because as he said, and as other parents and brothers and sisters and children of troops in Iraq told me on that day, it's impossible to heal from war. It's impossible. People do the best they can. Well, there have been wars for a long time. There was World War II. Something I discovered is that through the entire course of World War II, which took, of course, many lives, including American lives, public support in the United States for that war never fell below 77%. Never. The support level for the war in Iraq now is about 33%, which is where it was at the last years of the Vietnam War. So contrary to the media and political myth of this Vietnam syndrome that was discussed in the film clip here, it's not just that the public is adverse to war, although naturally people very much would like to not have their country and their sons and their daughters and their brothers and their sisters and their children going off to war. But it's when the discovery is made that the war has been based on lies. Now, what do we say about an individual leader or a system that will lie to the Congress, lie to the American people, because those leaders are determined to send the United States into war? And what does it mean to the soldiers and their loved ones and the friends and the population of this country as a whole when sooner or later it dawns on them that they've been lied into war? When I met Fernando Suarez del Solar, he told me that around the country when he goes and he talks to high schools and colleges, any classes he can get into, he talks about what happened to his son, Jesus, who lived with him and Jesus' mother in the San Diego area, believed in his country, volunteered for the military, went to Iraq, was one of the first U.S. soldiers killed after the invasion. And the Pentagon said, Fernando Suarez del Solar, you should be proud of your son. He died under enemy fire. And it wasn't until many, many, many months later, after digging and looking for documentation, Fernando discovered that his son had been killed not by the insurgents, the resistance, but killed by friendly fire. And there's a metaphor there. And when Fernando looked at the explanations for this war, he came up with a very succinct way of describing what had taken place. It's a message he has taken in the last couple of years around the country to students and others. Bush lied, my son died. And that reality for Fernando, for Carlos, for thousands and thousands of other Americans is one that, of course, will never go away. And in Iraq, if you are to look at the study that was published in the medical journal Lancet, perhaps 600,000 Iraqi people have died as a result of the U.S. invasion and occupation. And we're always left with the question, well, what does that have to do with me? I have a job, I go to school, I have my own social life, I have my career, I have my ambitions. And I think in a very real sense, most importantly, this evening together is not so much about Ruben Salazar, certainly, I think should be particularly about me. Most of all, it's about you. It's about what matters to you in your life. It's about what values you bring to the table every day. It's about whether history matters, whether you will help to create history or simply consume it like Wonder Bread off the shelf. And that is the basic plan. That is, if you will, the media and political script that you are most invited to adhere to. You, as a student, as a resident of the United States, as somebody who lives in this country, are invited to choose from the choices that are put forward to you in your education, in your profession, in your civic life. Choose from those choices. Don't create choices. Simply consume the ones that are on the shelf. In short, you are invited and encouraged to be obedient. You are encouraged to numb yourself, to accept the anesthetic of war, to accept that injustice is not particularly your concern, certainly not enough to change the way you live. And you are encouraged to buy into the anesthetic of life that is propagated by institutions that profit from war. You know, the latest budget that is now being proposed out of the White House brings close to $2 billion a day in military spending, courtesy of the U.S. taxpayers. Meanwhile, tuitions are going up. Meanwhile, healthcare co-pays are going up. I don't need to tell you the economic pressures on students and everyone else. And you look at the numbers and you see what could be done with the kind of money being shelled out to participate in Iraq in what Martin Luther King Jr. called the madness of militarism. And when Ruben Salazar was killed, and today we have that madness as part of our legacy and our current moment. And part of this process of getting us to accept what is handed to us, to not think too much about it, to not challenge it, is to rewrite history. You know, George Orwell said, those who control the past control the future. Those who control the present control the past. And so we're encouraged, for instance, to think of Martin Luther King as an idle dreamer, you know, a martyr on a postage stamp, somebody who had a dream. As Jesse Jackson has said, somebody who was with Dr. King when he died, it is the media that calls his famous speech in 1963 at the March on Washington the I Have a Dream speech. No, it was a promissory note speech. If you look at the text, he talked about the promises made to the people of this country, of all races, of all economic backgrounds, for justice, for the protections of the Constitution under law, for real opportunity and sustenance from their government. And it was a check that kept bouncing. It was a promissory note that kept not being fulfilled. And part of the way in which the media system, and unfortunately quite often the so-called educational system, a lot of the way in which there's an airbrushing of history is to remove, in true Orwellian fashion, the parts of history which might rock the big boats today. It's not as though the issues in 1970 were remote from what we're living in right now. You go to Salinas, where a couple of years ago there was a big push to shut down every public library in the city, including one named after a former famous resident of Salinas, John Steinbeck, another library, public library, named after Cesar Chavez. And then we were told that it was too expensive to keep the public libraries open. And I remember being outside the Cesar Chavez library, and at night during the protest, somebody had taken a projector and in odometer fashion, the projector showed the amount of money that had been paid by the taxpayers of Salinas, California, for the war in Iraq. At that point, $84 million. And yet the city can't afford, we were told, to keep its public libraries open. So those are the kind of choices that are made. That's what King was talking about in part in terms of the madness of militarism. When education becomes a process for the elite few when it comes to subsidies, where it's so expensive to go to college. Again, it's a notion that whatever it takes for the bombs and the missiles, for the mobilizations of troops. That's okay because it's worth it. In 1986, a man named Ben Linder was killed in Nicaragua. And I knew Ben when he was 17, 10 years earlier. He was a high school student in Portland, Oregon. He was somebody who cared about the world around him. And he became an engineer. And I forget what his salary was when he went to Nicaragua, to the countryside there. It was something like $17 a month, which could buy you a bit more in Nicaragua than it could here, but not a heck of a lot. And he worked to try to bring electricity to rural communities. And one day when he was at a little engineering plant out in the countryside in Nicaragua, some Contra guerrillas advanced on where he was working and shot him through the head at point-blank range. And without putting too fine a point on it, I think there are a lot of similarities between his death and the death of Ruben Salazar. When people get in the way of powerful interests, there are consequences. But the good news is that all through history, the social change has come from people organizing effectively. And it's simply impossible to stop a movement that reaches critical mass. And in that way, I think, you know, we may feel discouraged. We may think that these changes are impossible to create, the ones that we want to. And yet, part of what's been airbrushed out of history is that changes come from below. You don't ultimately get to create changes because somebody in power decides they're going to be a nice guy. It's because people organize effectively. And I think that's very, very inspiring, but it's a history that isn't really told us. You know, in the mass media, like, you know, the made-for-TV movies, or what is that movie with Sally Fields out in the sweatshop, you know, the textile shop, and the one smart person decides to organize, and that's how social change happens, but it's not really how it works. It works because people from the bottom up decide to work together. And if that hadn't happened, then the changes we see in the last couple of hundred years would have been much more slow in coming, if at all. Women getting the right to vote, African Americans getting the right to vote, the gay rights movement, all sorts of advances that we've had for human rights, for social justice and equality, ending the Vietnam War. It didn't happen. The end of the Vietnam War didn't happen out of the goodness of the heart, so to speak, of Richard Nixon, who you saw on the screen. Now, that moment that was captured on tape was never supposed to be released. Here's a guy that gets in front of the public and says, you know, I want peace so much. And you see these declassified tapes that were transcribed. We saw the words on the screen and the, you know, the kind of scratchy audio. But this is what he and the Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, were talking about. It's a whole different mindset. And so if we look ahead historically to the current time, we see a very similar situation where Carlos's son, Fernando's son, many other sons and daughters have been sent to Iraq for what? For what? If you look at the latest issue of Time magazine, anybody looked at the one with Condoleezza Rice on the cover? Feature story? Yeah, some of you have seen that. If you actually can stand to read the whole story, you'll see again and again they talk about how the idealistic goals of the Bush administration have been thwarted, that the White House has been trying to bring democracy to Iraq and the Middle East. And that is put forward without attribution. For those of you who study journalism, you know that information, assertions that lack documentation should be attributed. So-and-so said such-and-such. But that's not what Time magazine, which, by the way, is the largest circulation newsweekly in the country, that's not what Time magazine does in the latest issue. They simply say, as a point of fact, that the goal of the Bush administration has been in its Middle East policies to nurture democracy. Well, that doesn't pass the laugh test. This is part of the media mythology. And media mythology is not just some, you know, question of professional standards or academic evaluation or anything else. Just as Fernando said, Bush lied and my son died. When the news media lie, people die behind that too. That's what it's all about. That is the essence of propaganda. And propaganda is as vital to the war makers as the bombers and the bullets and the tanks and the jet fighters. Absolutely vital. You know, if we just had a dictatorship, it wouldn't matter what you and I thought, you know, because we wouldn't have the real potential day to day or year to year to affect policy. But we live in a society with significant aspects of democracy. And in that situation, it's vital that we've got to be spun 24/7. Turn on a television, with the exception of maybe the Colbert Report or, Jon Stewart. But with a few exceptions, you turn on network TV and you are being spun, just as you are when you read Time Magazine this week. This idea of the idealistic commitment coming out of U.S. foreign policy. And then within those parameters, there is all kinds of discourse and debate, sometimes bitter debate. You know, Bush is incompetent. Bush doesn't know what he's doing or how to do it. He doesn't know how to administer. He's made really bad decisions. All this sort of thing. Yes, there's fierce debate. But it goes to the motives. It's as though you read a story, you never get to see the plot. You go to the movie and they've chopped out whole sections of the film and you're supposed to make sense about it. No wonder so many people find politics boring. You know, I have people tell me, I read the New York Times and the Chronicle, cover to cover. I can't make heads or tails about what the hell's going on. You know, I watch network TV. It doesn't make sense to me. And I sympathize with that because they're basic facts of the story, basic analytical threads that could be pulled that just aren't there. I'll give you a three-letter word for one of those big, big threads. O-I-L, oil. You know, initially, what do they call it now? You have to brand everything, right? So you, just like Desert Storm, when 100,000 Iraqi people were slaughtered, courtesy of U.S. taxpayers in a six-week period in 1991, Operation Desert Storm. It sounds, you know, kind of like an act of God or nature, right? So everything has to be branded. Well, what do they call this now? Operation Iraqi Freedom? But before that, when the invasion was first being launched, the Pentagon said it was going to be called Operation Iraqi Liberation. And think about the acronym of Operation Iraqi Liberation. You can see the problem. So it had to be changed very quickly. But, you know, we have to be treated, you know, we're kind of infantilized by the news media, treated like we're, and I don't mean to be offensive to four-year-olds, but we're treated basically like we should be viewed as sort of four-year-olds. We can't really put the pieces of the puzzle together, nor should we be provided all the pieces of the puzzle. We're treated as though we're just going to be credulous of any sort of fantasy story that's put our way. And so, as I talk about in the War Made Easy book, there's been a drumbeat media effort to not only say that this war that is now taking so many lives with the U.S. occupation as the catalyst, not only to say that it's been about this idealistic yearning to establish democracy in the soil of the Middle East, but also what it isn't, that it isn't about oil. You know, the fact that there are 112 billion barrels of oil under the ground in Iraq, that has nothing to do with it. The fact that the per-barrel price of the oil that's known to be under the ground in Iraq is about $5 trillion, that has nothing to do with it, too. We're there out of the goodness of our hearts because we believe in democracy. That's why this war was launched on the basis of lies. And how offensive it would be, and many journalists, when you raise this question, there's this sort of a bristling. You know, how offensive to say it would be about something so crass as oil that would be a major consideration. And so a lot of this, and this goes back again to the cover story in Time Magazine this week, a lot of the media spin is to to weave this kind of web that is delusionary, kind of like the shadows on Plato's cave and all the rest of it. It's a sort of a notion that, as one journalist put it in a more candid moment, he says, we write fairy tales for grown-ups. That's what the daily newspaper is for. It's fairy tales for grown-ups. And so to go under the surface is really our challenge, and yet why wouldn't we want to? Why wouldn't we want to understand more clearly the world in which we live? Why wouldn't we want to understand a system that could take the life of my sister or my brother or myself? Wouldn't it be better not to be delusional? Wouldn't it be better to be skeptical, to think for ourselves, to challenge each other, to go deeper? Wouldn't it be helpful, for instance, if we're going to understand the warfare state in which we live, to look at the annual reports of Boeing and McDonnell Douglas and other military contractors while the U.S. government picks your pocket to line their coffers with these huge profits? Might it not be helpful to go through these annual reports? Well, I've done that. I've looked at the contracts of those corporations like McDonnell Douglas or Boeing with grossing $50 billion a year from the U.S. Treasury for the latest state-of-the-art killing machines, or the smaller contractors that are making just tens of millions of dollars a year. And you can read those annual reports, and by all means, as with all of this, don't take my word for it. If you take a look at the War Made Easy book, look at the endnotes and the documentation. Look at those annual reports, and you will find statements time and again, because, legally, at least in the fine print of the prospectus and the annual reports, these corporations have to achieve a certain level of candor with potential investors. So you look at what Boeing says and these other corporations, and they say point blank in their annual reports, we think our prospects for continued growth and large profits are very good because the threat of peace is very low. The danger that peace will emerge and the end of a war on terrorism will take place is very small. And so we're confident that continued large profit margins will be available for investors. You can read the Wall Street Journal and especially the editorial page or the New York Times or the Santa Cruz Sentinel or whatever for a month of Sundays and beyond and keep reading. And somehow that never comes across. And if you look, for instance, we've talked about commercial media, but anybody here watch the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer or Washington Week on PBS? This is supposed to be really quality stuff, right? And you look at, say, Washington Week on Friday, and this is where the journalists sit around the table and exchange conventional wisdom for half an hour, and we all come out of the viewing experience so enlightened. And last year, when I was doing some writing about the program, I looked at who the sponsors are. But they're not called sponsors on so-called public broadcasting. They're called those who purchase enhanced underwriter credits. And you can tell because, if you're watching CNN or CBS, then the commercials, they might have rock and roll or something. But it's so much cultured, so much more cultured on PBS. So the enhanced underwriter credits, which are just as long, will maybe be selling you a Volvo and it'll be Mozart and, you can feel very erudite about it. Or they simply give a pitch for those who are providing, those corporations that are underwriting, i.e. sponsoring the program. Well, who signed on in early 2006 on the program to be a major funder to the tune of into $1 million or more? Well, it's an outfit called Boeing. Why would the Boeing Corporation want to subsidize this crucial program, very widely watched, very influential on PBS about what's going on in Washington, D.C. politically? Well, of course, there are literally billions of dollars involved in profits, depending on decisions made in Washington that will affect the military contracts for Boeing and other and their competitors. And budget cuts to the Pentagon would be disastrous for Boeing, for instance. And then who's another big sponsor who signed on early last year? Chevron. Can you think of two corporations with more at stake on Capitol Hill and in Washington than a huge oil conglomerate or a huge military contractor? And so that's a bit of a clue. I mean, this is supposed to be the best news media we get in the country in terms of mass distribution, millions of viewers on these programs. And yet they are subjected to what Fred Friendly, who was one of what were called the Murrow's Boys, you know, if you saw Good Night and Good Luck, Fred Friendly is one of the characters in there, later, briefly president of CBS. Friendly called this the positive veto, and it is very powerful on so-called public broadcasting. It's a positive veto in that if you've got these corporations and other funding sources pouring millions of dollars into a program, then the program's going to exist. It's a positive veto. But in the absence of that kind of big corporate money behind it, the program may never exist in the first place, or it may founder and drop from the scene. And so when we're looking for adequate sources of information, we've got to check around, you know. And I think we need to, you know, I was talking earlier about the need to be skeptical. You know, don't take my word for anything or anybody else's word for anything. Think for yourself, check out the research, draw your own conclusions. I'm not saying be cynical, but I'm saying be skeptical. And if we're going to look at the terrain and the information available, we got to just, you know, unplug from the main line of the corporate media. And that includes the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. It includes All Things Considered and Morning Edition on NPR. We got it. Yes, we should be looking at that. We should also be looking at other sources. Democracy Now! On radio and TV. The Nation magazine, The Progressive, In These Times, Mother Jones, Z Magazine, websites, Common Dreams, Fair, Truth Out, Alternet, TomPaine.com, you've seen them, you know ones that I don't know, but there's certainly many ways that we can search for other kinds of information. And I think that ultimately gives us the hope that we can make an informed choice. And that really brings us back, I think, to Ruben Salazar. Because everything in the work he did, reporting from Vietnam and Mexico and the barrios, it was about giving people real information, so that we would understand what was being done with our tax dollars in our names. We would understand that the future is not just for us to consume passively, but that history is really ours to create. And with that, I'll look forward to your questions and your comments. I think we have a microphone up here.
Thank you for coming. Really appreciated all the words you had. Given the conglomeration of our news media, the censorship of information between the relationship of war and peace, even further embedded journalists, how can we everyday Americans get the facts straight about Iraq? Even further, how can we perpetuate peace in light of a war on terrorism?
Well, I think it's very possible for us to sort through the information. And through all historical periods, there have been people who said, well, you know, it's too complicated to leave it to the experts. And we know where that leads. And there's no silver bullet. You know, there's no guarantee. I understand people get discouraged. Everybody at some times, or at least almost everybody, I would guess, feels real discouragement. But we're somewhat acculturated, and I was kind of alluding to this about the Norma Rae sort of a film, or the notion that we're just waiting for that hero. You know, it wasn't as great as Martin Luther King was. It wasn't a civil rights movement because of him. It was because of so many, many, many thousands of people. And I think there really is hope there that we can mobilize. It's not that it's a lead pipe cinch, that there's anything sure about it. And I have talked with people, and sometimes they'll say, well, you know, I could give up my graduate school, I could give up my nice apartment, I could give up whatever, and put in so much of my time doing political work of some sort or another, and maybe nothing will change, it'll be all for nothing. You know, and you might see that person go down to the 7-Eleven and scratch off the lotto on the very tiny chance that they're going to, you know, get a big prize. You know, so in a lot of parts of our lives, we're willing to do all sorts of things that are long shots, or certainly aren't guaranteed. Almost nothing's guaranteed in life. But the possibility is there. And so I think it's part of it's a kind of a cultural milieu that is at stake as well, which goes to the quality of life. You know, Fred Branfman, who was a volunteer in Laos and discovered that the United States in the late 60s was slaughtering vast numbers of Laotians who didn't even know what the United States was with these huge bombing campaigns. I talked to him recently. He said, you know, I don't really do what I do or never did what I did out of hope, per se. I did it because I'm a human being. And when I see what's going on with other human beings, I want to have a positive effect. And I think ultimately that's a very powerful reality that is how we've had all these positive changes. Other comments or questions?
Hi. You were talking about the government lying for justifications of going to war, and yes, I agree that, like, the Iraq war, there are some shady issues there. But on September 11th, 2001, we had a bunch of airplanes crash into several of our buildings, including the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And for that, we invaded Afghanistan. What about that war, which you kind of sidestepped?
Mm-hmm. Well, about the Afghanistan war.
Yeah.
Well, my friend Medea Benjamin, a couple of months after the October attack on Afghanistan was launched, and by the way, I talk about the war on Afghanistan in my book, War Made Easy. Medea went to rural Afghanistan and talked to a woman who had lost most of the members of her family to the U.S. bombing. And she said, what do you think of... Medea asked this woman, what do you think of Osama bin Laden and what do you think of the United States? And the woman replied, who is Osama bin Laden and what is the United States? You know, if... that person hits me and I hit you in response, you might wonder what the heck is going on. It was a therapeutic attack. It was us to feel like, the United States to feel like we did something in response. It was a bait and switch operation. All the flags, all the grief, all the emotion was largely channeled to the attack on Afghanistan to make us feel better. But as you can see now with what's going on in Afghanistan, it solved absolutely nothing. There was a CIA analysis within a year after the attack began in Afghanistan that if anything, al-Qaeda was strengthened by the attacks. The diffusion of Afghanistan, of formerly Afghanistan-based cells of al-Qaeda around Europe, Africa, and elsewhere. The anger that was generated that helped Afghanistan be a place where people could be recruited against the United States. And so I think it, you know, it kind of comes back to what our goals are here. Our goals to feel like we are righteous. Is it self-therapy? Is it to make us feel like, well, we got hurt, but then we hurt somebody else? And it goes to some deeper questions, which I'm sure if you read Greek plays, you see some of these issues have been troubling people for thousands of years and struggling with them. As issues and concerns, ethical ones, if you will. I'm not a pacifist, but I think that a very, very high threshold for war needs to be maintained. And in the last 50 years, none of those thresholds have been met. Every single war from Vietnam to the present day has been based on fundamental lies, as I talk about in the book, and counterproductive at that. There were ads put out by some anti-war groups before the invasion of Iraq with that Uncle Sam wants you poster, but instead of Uncle Sam, it was Osama bin Laden. He said, I want you to invade Iraq. And indeed, the invasion of Iraq was a big favor that the U.S. did for the likes of al-Qaeda. I certainly think al-Qaeda was not hurt in the long run by bombing Afghanistan. The number of civilians, according to a study done out of the University of New Hampshire by the end of that year, Mark Harold, a professor there, found that by the end of 2001, more Afghan people had been killed by the U.S., civilians had been killed by the U.S. than those who died at the World Trade Center. So then we can ask ourselves, well, then what does that mean? You know, the people who the U.S. killed in Iraq, or rather in Afghanistan, were no more guilty of any wrongdoing than those who died on 9/11. So what's the message here? That we can outdo al-Qaeda, that we can be better at violence than anybody else on the planet? The poet W.H. Auden in 1939 wrote a poem and he said, those to whom evil is done do evil in return. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. And when we're in that cycle, then it never ends, because I guarantee you there are always good excuses that the U.S. government will have for slaughtering people, just as there will always be good excuses that al-Qaeda will have for slaughtering people. And on 9/11, Colin Powell was in Latin America, and he initially released a statement in which he condemned those who, as he put it, and I quote this in my book, those who, as he put it, destroy buildings and kill people because of a political agenda. And I certainly agree with what Colin Powell said that day. I condemn those who destroy buildings and kill people for a political agenda. A problem, though, is that Colin Powell was instrumental in doing exactly that. And at the end of the Gulf War that he was such a hero of in 1991, he gave an interview at the Pentagon with the New York Times, and he was asked about a number that had just been floated, the 100,000 that I mentioned of Iraqis killed in 6 weeks by the Pentagon. And the quote from Powell was, that's not a number I'm particularly interested in. So there you have kind of the banality of evil. You know, he's a very good soldier, very good at it, has his rationale. If we want that kind of leadership, we certainly have it.
I have kind of a two-part question. The first part is, you talked about Time magazine and some of the fundamental assumptions that they operate from in their so-called journalism, where they just assume that the motives of the administration were to bring democracy. I'm wondering how you think NPR, I find they make the same fundamental assumptions in the reporting, and I'm wondering what you think of NPR in that regard. And then the other half of the question is, you talked about oil and how this is never talked about as a reason. Well, generally in the mainstream media, it's not really discussed as a reason for the war. If you could speak a little bit to how the U.S. government is trying to influence the way that the Iraqi government is putting laws into place right now to govern how oil is managed there.
Yeah. Well, NPR News, I think they do really wonderful high jumps over low standards. You know, all things considered in Morning Edition, you compare it to Fox News, you know, or something, it's considered really great. It's official source journalism. When you get to foreign policy coverage, it's mediocre at best. If you look at what NPR News on All Things Considered in Morning Edition did in the many months lead up to the invasion of Iraq, they were horrendous. You know, it could have been written by the Pentagon. Let's look at the New York Times, which again, along with NPR, is considered a wonderful news source. Under the byline of Judith Miller and others, absolute falsehoods were floated as absolute truths. The finest journalism of the, you know, American corporate media. And in fact, you had people out of Dick Cheney's office and Rumsfeld's office leaking stuff through the Pentagon's favorite Iraqi exile who hadn't been there for a few decades in Iraq, Ahmed Shalabi. And the Pentagon would leak this stuff, which was often absolute falsehoods about weapons of mass destruction, and then it would be on the front page of the New York Times, and then Donald Rumsfeld would get on television, or Dick Cheney would get on, and he'd say, well, don't just take my word for it. Look at what the New York Times reported. And NPR, just to get back to your question, NPR has been, I think, for those who are looking to it, for real quality independent journalism, a real disappointment. In terms of the oil question, I'm trying to remember exactly what you were... Oh, yes, right. Yeah, well, this is one of the huge unreported stories where the U.S. government first with under the provisional authority and Mr. Paul Bremer and so forth, and now more recently, has gotten the so-called Iraqi government to pass all sorts of regulations and now long-running law that will make it very easy for the Western-based and U.S.-based oil companies to lock in very favorable contracts for oil access. For people who are looking for more information, our website at the Institute for Public Accuracy has a good search mechanism there, and just type in Iraq and oil. We're at www.accuracy.org. But again, this is something that's very soft-pedaled in the U.S. media because, of course, the United States of America isn't run by people who would actually drag the country into war because of oil. You know, that's beyond the pale of reasonable discussion in the news media.
Thanks for coming. I was just wondering, I kind of feel like as a group, an academic group in this generation, is very much primed for being able to be some sort of active force in the world to combat some of these injustices, both on America's part and globally. Do you feel like there's any leaders or movements in particular, kind of in the vein of Martin Luther King, that are really kind of being able to bring everything to a head and really be active in a large group setting like that?
Yeah, I think there are really important organizing efforts going on around the country, and it's a range of issues. And often it's kind of like the lily pad effect, as it's been called, where you might have a lake and, you know, one lily pad there and another and another, and it seems like very little is happening. But there can be a sort of a catalyst, and pretty soon all the water's filled with lily pads. And that happens a lot with social movements. It happened, for instance, in the late 90s. You know, people had been meeting in their living rooms and having little websites about corporate globalization, the World Trade Organization. And for most people, it seemed like a real yawner. And then Seattle, 1999, the place is shut down by civil disobedience, and it had huge ripple effects. So that's an example of something that can have a big impact. I think students are organizing around environmental issues. As you know, sometimes trees are in the sites of the developers, and trees are protected, environmental watersheds protected. All that sort of activity, I think, is very important. Issues around global warming, people are mobilizing. Of course, anti-war organizing and some of the budget issues now with the new budget proposed by Bush coming into the fore. We had on January 27th, not only in Washington, D.C., where, depending on the numbers, 100,000, 200,000 people rallied against the war, but across the country. So, I mean, I think that there are so many things going on. Of course, we wish it was happening faster and more effectively, but, you know, whatever is speaking to your passions, I would encourage getting more involved. Any other comments, questions?
Thank you so much for coming. I was wondering what you thought of foreign news coverage, like the BBC or French newspapers or anything like that.
Well, the spectrum of U.S. media coverage around a lot of issues is, you know, the one that we're accustomed to. For instance, you'll hear about the liberal media, and the New York Times is supposedly a liberal newspaper, whatever that means. But if it was in Western Europe, it would be considered kind of a center-right newspaper, and that just goes to the kind of spectrum that we have. If you looked at the British press in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, there was a lot more skepticism, and I'll give you one example. And it's not to say that they have a wonderful press, because a lot of it's Murdoch-owned, and a lot of it's pretty terrible. But if you look at Colin Powell's speech at the United Nations in early February 2003, he held up the vials of chemical, biological weapons as an example. He showed the satellite pictures and all that. And as I talk about in the War Made Easy book, there was a just immediate, massive acclaim from the U.S. news media. Even supposedly an anti-war outlet like the New York Times ran an editorial the next day, just praising his presentation, how convincing it was. Well, you know, there's a myth that's grown up that we all thought that there were weapons of mass destruction. I'm here to tell you it's an absolute lie. I mean, we're not all that smart at the Institute for Public Accuracy, but we know when we're being hornswoggled. You know, we haven't changed a word on our news releases that we put out July, August, September through 2002, well before the war, and at the time of Powell's presentation before the invasion. We said this WMD story is full of holes. A lot of other people said that as well. The news media gave very little attention to that skepticism because the U.S. government was saying it, therefore it must be true, and we all knew what integrity Colin Powell said had, and he wouldn't lie to us, and so it goes. You look at the British press at the time. Within days of Powell's speech at the UN, much of the British press, The Guardian, The Independent, The Observer, they had shredded Powell's speech because it was so flagrantly deceptive. So I think I'd be glad to talk to people in smaller groups if you have additional questions, but I really want to thank all the organizers of this event tonight and to thank all of you for being here.
And that was author and media critic Norman Solomon receiving the 3rd annual Ruben Salazar Journalism Award on Wednesday, February 7, 2007 at UCSC. The annual award honors the memory of independent journalist Ruben Salazar, who was killed during a Vietnam War protest in East Los Angeles when he was hit at close range in the head by a police tear gas canister. Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman and co-host Juan Gonzalez are previous award winners. Norman Solomon is a nationally syndicated columnist on media and politics. He is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a national consortium of policy researchers and analysts. His columns have appeared in such publications as the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, Newsday, the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and USA Today. Solomon has appeared on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, and C-SPAN's Washington Journal and Book TV, and has been a guest on various national public radio programs. His last book, Target Iraq, What the News Media Did Not Tell You, has been translated into Italian, German, Hungarian, and Korean. And his latest book is called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. If you want more information about Norman Solomon or the Institute for Public Accuracy, you can go to accuracy.org.